The Ukrainian president says Russia's weekend attack on an apartment building in the central city of Dnipro shows the need for faster decisions on supplying arms to Kiev. The Turkish president says Sweden and Finland must extradite up to 130, quote, terrorists before Ankara approves their bids to join NATO. And U.S. police arrest an unsuccessful Republican State House candidate for orchestrating shootings. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumish Ahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Ukraine's president describes as a war crime Russia's weekend attack on the central city of Dnipro, vowing to bring to justice those behind the strike.
The security service of Ukraine has already started to gather information about the Russian military that prepared and carried out this strike. Undoubtedly, every person guilty of this war crime will be identified and held responsible. This strike at Dnipro, as well as other similar strikes, falls in particular under the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court, and we will use all available opportunities, both national and international, to ensure that all Russian murderers, everyone who gives and executes orders on missile terror against our people, face legal sentences, and to ensure that they serve their punishment.
The attack hit a residential building, killing 40 people and wounding nearly 80. Rescuers are still searching for 25 people who remain missing. Russia has denied involvement in the strike, saying Ukraine's air defense system caused the damage. The Ukrainian president is now saying the attack highlights the need for the West to accelerate arms supplies to Kiev.
What happened in Dnipro, the fact that Russia is preparing a new attempt to seize the initiative in the war, the fact that the nature of hostilities at the front requires new decisions in the defense supply, all this only emphasizes how important it is to coordinate our efforts, the efforts of all members of the coalition to defend Ukraine and freedom and to speed up decision making.
The Ukrainian Army's general staff also called for faster weapons deliveries, adding that his country has been under heavy Russian attacks in the past 24 hours. The U.S. and its Western allies have been the main suppliers of arms to Ukraine. On Monday, U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman visited Kiev and renewed Washington's commitment to the shipment of more weapons. Russia sees this as Western interference in the conflict that will prolong Ukraine's suffering. Turkey is demanding that Sweden and Finland hand over up to 130, quote, terrorists before Ankara approves their bids to join NATO. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan says he has warned the two countries that their accession bids would not be approved by the Turkish parliament if the terrorists are not deported. Turkey had earlier warned Sweden in particular that it must first take a clear stance against what Ankara sees as a terrorist group. They include Kurdish militants and a group that Turkey blames for a 2016 coup attempt. The two Nordic countries applied for NATO membership last year. Their request must be upheld by all 30 member states. Turkey and Hungary are two remaining members of the military alliance that have not endorsed their applications yet. In the UK, teachers and nurses are set to go on a wage strike and a fresh headache for the government. Over 23,000 schools in England and Wales will be impacted by teacher strikes planned for February. The first teachers in Scotland have already stopped work, which has closed many schools. Britain's largest education union says government offered a 5% pay rise, and this is in fact a wage cut to spiraling prices. Tens of thousands of nurses in England are also planning strikes in February. Their trade union says a stoppage will take place if progress is not made by the end of this month in pay negotiations with the government. Months of strikes across various sectors have caused widespread disruption in the UK, which is suffering from decades-high inflation. The government says it cannot afford big wage hikes. And the EU faces economic uncertainty in 2023 due to gas supply issues. The European Commission has acknowledged that energy sanctions against Russia are backfiring to some extent. Jerome Hughes reports.
On Monday, Eurozone finance ministers marked the occasion of Croatia becoming the 20th member of the Eurogroup. However, Zagreb joins the euro at a very precarious time for the currency. The big question is, where will the EU get its gas in 2023 and at what price?
While high storage levels and lower demand have helped to bring energy prices down, the crisis is certainly not over.
The EU insists its move to cut out Russian energy over the war in Ukraine has damaged Moscow. But for the first time, there's an acknowledgement of collateral damage.
If you are cutting trade, if you are cutting imports, exports, the bilateral relations with the partner with whom you had a lot of to do with before, then of course there is some negative impact on our side.
Experts say the EU has always been overly dependent on imports of gas, oil and raw materials. It's a reality that won't change.
They all have to be imported in a way that other regions don't. And that means that the European Union is very vulnerable, and it also has to look very carefully where it makes geostrategic alliances.
To obtain essential supplies, the EU will turn a blind eye to crimes committed by the likes of Saudi Arabia and Qatar, according to analysts. Despite enormous economic uncertainty at home, the EU is promising more financial aid for Ukraine.
We will continue to provide strong military, financial, diplomatic and political support to Ukraine and to the Ukrainian people. Together, the EU and its member states have contributed nearly 50 billion euros.
The European Commission has already organized 18 billion euro for Ukraine in 2023. The first tranche is currently being released. The EU will send a further 3 billion euro to Ukraine on Tuesday. As social inequality grows across the bloc, more and more people are asking, can we really afford to keep doing this? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
In the U.S., a Republican who was defeated in New Mexico state Senate elections is arrested for orchestrating shootings at the homes of four elected Democratic officials. Local police say Solomon Pena paid four men to target the homes of two county commissioners and two state legislators. The incidents took place in December 2022 and early January this year. Police say Pena was also personally involved in the shootings. The Republican lost in the race for the local Senate to an incumbent Democrat in November. Pena did not admit his defeat and posted a controversial photo of himself on social media. The photo showed him wearing clothes with slogans reminiscent of how former President Donald Trump denied his loss in the 2020 presidential vote. Peru's anti-government rallies show no sign of abating as protesters from across the country head to the capital, Lima, for a mass gathering.
We came peacefully with our small vehicles, simply bringing our food, our clothes, to be able to get to Lima and at the same time protest peacefully against this government, which is harming the country.
Most people from the provinces are coming to Lima, so the departures need to occur daily, so we can overtake the Congress.
A convoy of trucks carrying protesters has left the southern city of Andalusia. Large groups of farmers are also traveling to the capital from other southern areas, including from the Flashpoint, Cusco province. Peru has been witnessing back-to-back protests for weeks over the ouster of former President Pedro Castillo. They have engaged in clashes with police, especially in the south, that have killed 42 people. Protesters want Castillo to be freed from prison. He was arrested after he attempted to dissolve Congress to avoid impeachment in December. The demonstrators, who also want his successor, Dina Boluarte, to step down. A rights group says Israel has killed 20 children in attacks on the Gaza Strip in 2022. The Gaza-based Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights says three of the kids lost their lives as regime forces prevented them from seeking medical care in hospitals. According to Al-Mizan, the Israeli raids also injured at least 170 children. Many of the dead and injured were shot during anti-regime protests along the separation barrier borders in the Gaza Strip. The group says 23 children were also arrested in the territory last year. Israel blockaded Gaza Strip in 2007, turning the enclave into an open-air prison. The regime has also launched four major wars against the coastal territory, killing and injuring thousands of Palestinians. Protests are continuing against the new far-right Israeli cabinet led by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, with thousands of students joining in. Protests were held in over a dozen university and college campuses, including in Tel Aviv, Haifa, and Al-Quds. They left their classes to stage coordinated strikes against the cabinet's plan for so-called judicial reforms. Four students were arrested in Al-Quds, with protest organizers complaining of bullying by police forces. The new Israeli cabinet is under fire for its attempt to decrease the power of the Supreme Court in its own favor. This amid the Prime Minister's own efforts to dodge charges of bribery, fraud, and breach of trust.
Israel is experiencing unprecedented mass protests. Tens of thousands of Israelis have hit the streets in several cities, including Tel Aviv, Al-Quds, and Haifa, for the second consecutive week to protest against plans by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to implement changes to Israel's legal system and weaken the Supreme Court. The demonstration presents an early challenge to Netanyahu and his far-right minister, Etmar Ben-Gvir, who has ordered police to take tough action if protesters block roads or display Palestinian flags. In defiance of Ben-Gvir's call, some footage showed Palestinian flags on display. The crowd in Tel Aviv swelled to more than 80,000 people despite rainy weather there. Demonstrators, many covered by umbrellas, held signs and chanted slogans like criminal government or the end of democracy. But what were they protesting that gave way to such a large crowd to come out?
We would like to say that the current coalition in Israel would like to change the regime to make us like a dark regime. In the world, and we will not accept it, and will fight for this democracy.
The focus of the protests was how the new coalition cabinet, headed by Netanyahu, wants to decrease the power of the Supreme Courts in its own favor. This as Netanyahu is trying to escape charges of bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. The situation has already angered Israeli officials, including the president. Herzog also warned that Israel faced, quote, a historic constitutional crisis over the contested judicial reform plan. But despite all that criticism, Netanyahu has pledged to complete legislating the reforms in a way that will correct what needs correcting, totally protect individual rights, as he claims, and restore the public's faith in the justice system that so much requires such reform. The legal changes could help Netanyahu evade eviction of corruption or even make his trial disappear entirely.
Israel is grappling with numerous issues. The regime faces a challenge posed by the rise in new Palestinian resistance groups, as well as biting cost of living crisis and internal political divisions. All these point to the question whether Israel is riding for a fall, especially seeing the comments by former Prime Minister Ehud Barak, who warned back in May that the regime could disintegrate before its 80th anniversary.
In office for more than just 2 weeks, Benjamin Netanyahu's right-wing cabinet has launched proposals to weaken the Supreme Court by giving parliament the power to overturn court decisions with a simple majority vote. It also wants to give parliament control over the appointment of judges and reduce the independence of legal advisors. Israeli opposition leaders, former attorneys general, and the president of Israel's Supreme Court have all spoken out against the plan. They said the move would cripple judicial independence, foster corruption, set back minority rights, and deprive Israel's courts of credibility that helps fend off war crimes abroad. Critics said the changes could help Netanyahu evade conviction in his corruption trial or make the trial disappear altogether. But are these protests against Netanyahu himself? Netanyahu's premiership in the past has been fraught not only with trying to escape corruption charges, but also violations like Palestinian rights, settlement construction, and other hot-button issues that exist between Palestinians and Israel. Inside Israel, the opposition against the current right-wing cabinet and Netanyahu is so high and elevated that a new movement has been created to promote and encourage Israelis to leave Israel, with a group planning to move 10,000 Israeli Jews in the first stage of its project. Meanwhile, grassroots Palestinians with no affiliation to any of the resistance groups are rising against the regime. Den of Lions is one, an independent armed Palestinian group operating in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. In the meantime, the current right-wing cabinet and its far-right minister Ben-Gvir are advocating more violence against Palestinians, which would lead to more deaths, including violations like settlement buildings, changing the demographics of Al-Aqsa and Al-Quds, and other core issues. The cost of living is one other major issue protesters are angry with. After all, Israel is expensive and has one of the highest costs of living in the world. With all the crises the regime is grappling with, what seems to be on the corner for officials in Tel Aviv is what a protester said during a Saturday demonstration. "I came here to demonstrate against the anti-democratic steps of the new cabinet. This can be the start of the end of the Jewish state as we know it. Is this cabinet igniting the start of the end of Israel?" This exactly signifies what former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak expressed concern about: the survival of Israel. Barak said the entity will cease to exist before the 80th anniversary of its 1948 establishment. He said throughout the Jewish history, the Jews did not rule for more than 80 years, except in the two kingdoms of David and the Hasmonean dynasty. And in both periods, their disintegration began in the 8th decade.
That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you remember, we talked about Imam Khomeini's view on women and their status and role in family and society. In this episode, we are going to dwell upon the participation of some members of Imam Khomeini's family in the battlefronts during the eight-year imposed war in 1980s. Stay tuned, please. Sayyid Hassan Khomeini, grandson of Imam Khomeini and son of late Haj Ahmad Agha, was one of the members of the Imam's family who rushed to the front to take part in the nationwide struggle against the invading Saddam army. In 1987, he was studying at high school. At first, some of the family members didn't agree with Sayyid Hassan's going to the front. The reason for their disagreement was that, in case of Sayyid Hassan's captivity by the Iraqi military, it would demoralize the combatants. Fatemeh Tabatabai, wife of Ahmad Agha, says on the issue, "When our son was 13, Ahmad told him to go to the front. I told him that he was too young, but Ahmad told Hassan, 'Look, dear Hassan, perhaps you think why I myself don't go to the front. My body and spirit is in the front, but I think that presently taking care of the Imam is a greater obligation for me than going to the front.'" Imam Khomeini's daughter-in-law continues, "Ahmad started to talk about the benefits of going to the front. He said, 'Now I tell you something, but all these things will finish tomorrow. This divine mercy will not be there forever so that you can benefit from it. Now it is the best opportunity to go to the war fronts and use this situation. I say these things so that later on you may not tell me, 'Daddy, I was not mature, but why didn't you tell me?' All the better if you are martyred, but that will be good even if you are injured. However, you should try not to be captivated because it will cause many problems." The words of father affected the son, and the latter left for the front as a teenager. He was in the battlefront for a few months. Hujjat al-Islam Masih Burujerdi was another grandson of Imam Khomeini who participated in the war fronts in 1980s. He was sent to Khatam al-Anbiya base, but no one had noticed his relation with Imam Khomeini due to his family name. In fact, he was the son of one of Imam's daughters. Masih Burujerdi preferred to be unknown. Dr. Rajai from the Imam's office was in the front in those days and was aware of the issue. He relates, "At that time, no one from the combatants and commanders of war noticed that this Basiji student who performs the congregational prayers quietly and anonymously was the Imam's grandson, Masih Burujerdi. When this young grandson of Imam Khomeini was about to leave for the front, some of the relatives went to the Imam's wife to dissuade him. Ms. Khadija Saghafi told them, 'You pray for all combatants, including our Masih. Pray for him to be a useful person in the front and return with health.' Thus, Masih left for the front and came back after a while with health." Majid Qaravi was Ms. Saghafi's nephew who was martyred during Karbala 5 operation in Shalamche front. Majid had finished high school in 1983 and started studying in urbanization field at Mashhad University. He went to the battle fronts in 1986. At first, he was injured during the operation for liberation of Mehran City. After relative healing in Tehran, he left for the France again and attained the Elixir of Martyrdom in the epic Karbala 5 operation. He was very effective in persuading his friends and classmates to go to the France. He had told his friends at the university, "Our studying is for God's satisfaction, and now God is more satisfied if we go to the France." In his last will, Majid had asked his mother to intercede for him on the Day of Judgment. When the Imam's wife read his last will, she told her sister, Majid's mother, with tears in her eyes, "It is he who should intercede for you and us." No doubt, these pure and humble youths safeguarded Iran and the Islamic Revolution against enemies and turned Iran into a great power in the region and the world. We plead God for exaltation of their degrees in paradise and helping us follow their path. Amen.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has slammed Kiev's destructive policies and growing Western arms supplies to Ukraine. Reference to Poland and the UK in this case, who have said that they will provide main battle tanks. Now, Russia has said that this means that they want the conflict in Ukraine to spiral even further, adding that those tanks can burn, and they will burn like the rest of the weapons. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at whether this war will end on the battlefield or at the diplomatic table, something which the U.S. cannot come to grips with yet. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Fred Weir, journalist and political commentator, joins us from Moscow. Also joining us is Harley Schlanger, a spokesman for the LaRouche organization, who joins us from Potsdam, Germany.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Fred, we all start with you. The latest is Britain's decision to provide Ukraine with these tanks by the name of 14 Challenger. Two tanks is the name to help counter Russia, as Downing Street has said, in the coming weeks. And the curious part about this, which I want to ask you, is that it's the first time that, as this was reported, a Western country has provided Ukraine with tanks. Why hasn't Ukraine received tanks before from a Western country?
Ukraine started the war with a lot of tanks. This is a sign, I guess, that they're pretty much drawn down their original arsenal. In fact, they've been resupplied several times. It's, I guess, also a sign that the Western countries are running out of ways to help Ukraine. I think that there have been several waves of, you know, weaponry, you know, starting at the beginning. You remember the Javelin missiles and all the hype about that. Then there were these HIMARS. And now it's about tanks and fighting vehicles. I think when the Russians say it won't make any difference on the battlefield, they're right in the big sense. It won't change the tide of war any more than the previous weapons did, but it will prolong the war. It will give the Ukrainians, because they have plenty of manpower, another set of armaments with which to launch new offensives.
All right, a couple points there, Harley Schneider, that I want to ask you. First of all, what Fred Weir said is really important in order to grasp this, and that is why in waves there are these announcements that are made about weaponry. I mean, it's pretty much been going on for quite some time. My question would be, first, why don't they just come out and give them all? What's the problem there? Now, secondly, the fact that this won't change the tide of war based on the most recent deployment that Britain has said, and that is about these tanks.
Well, there are two points here that are important. First, NATO's goal is a permanent war until it weakens Russia to the point where NATO can do whatever it wants. The problem that NATO and the West has, the transatlantic, the U.S., the Anglo-American side, their problem is that they're trying to stop the development of a new financial system, a new strategic orientation away from Europe. And this is already occurring with Russia, with China, countries like India, the BRICS countries. They're moving in a different direction. And so
can you repeat that one more time? I'm trying to understand what you just said, so if you don't mind repeating it one more time, I'm sorry.
Sure. Why is NATO committed to a permanent war against Russia? Because Russia refuses to accept the idea of a Western rules-based order, which is not based on rules, it's not based on international law, it's based on the supremacy of the financial empire out of London and Wall Street. And unfortunately, European countries submit to that. And so that's why they're providing waves of weapons. They thought the sanctions would destroy Russia. The sanctions didn't. They thought that they could turn the world against Russia and isolate Russia. They didn't. In fact, Russia is less isolated today than ever with alliances such as the BRICS, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and others. So the idea that more weapons will weaken Russia is the only thing they have. And the problem they have is that it's not going to win a war, but they're committed to permanent warfare. And that's something that people in the West don't understand. They believe the lie that Russia is losing, that Ukraine will win, and if we just provide a little bit more weapons, that will turn the tide. One final point on this. The United Kingdom is going through a horrible economic crisis. And the question has to be raised, how can Sunak justify sending more weapons when the British economy is on its back? There are strike waves, the population is angry. So I think the West has a losing hand, but they're going to continue the war as long as they can.
I'm curious as to why you picked the UK and not Germany.
Well, Germany is also facing a problem, but Germany still has more production and more riches than the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom is quite weak economically, except for the city of London. But the problem is paper money and computer notations don't win a war. And NATO is trying to force Germany to provide more weapons, and there's resistance in Germany.
Okay. Taking a look at the notion of what our guest there, Harley Schlanger, said, Fred Weir. The whole notion of where this war is going to define which side has won or not, that's a big question mark. And who's to judge how that's going to happen? But at some point, that is bound to happen, especially given the way that we're seeing some of the important developments unfold, such as the batch of, again, military, not only military weaponry, but also the fact that we are getting reports, as I'm sure you're well aware, that both NATO and the U.S. and some of these European countries are running out of ammunition. They're running out of weaponry. So where is that going to, when is that going to reach, what time frame, and what is the definition of who has lost or who has won?
That's a huge question, and I can't answer it. I think there's a lot more to be, sad to say, to be played out on the battlefield. I think that what's going on in Donbass, whatever offensives are coming up before spring or by spring, may give us a much clearer idea of how the war can end. But however it does end, there's no doubt that the world system, that globalization that we experienced over the past 30 years or so, and for some of us, for a lot of people in the global south, but for people like me, that was a really great time. If you had money, if you were prosperous, you could travel, you could enjoy cheap consumer goods. There was just almost no limit to what, you know, to the possibilities in that economic system, and that is fracturing now. We're going to end up with a divided world, with probably countries like Russia, Iran, China on one side, not just politically or geopolitically, but also economically, and the West on in another realm. Not perhaps quite like it was in the old Cold War, not an ideologically divided world or so strictly divided, but still not a functioning global system. And that will be the outcome of this war, no matter who supposedly wins it.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, we seem to be going on to this economically driven point that is being made, especially when rules-based order, as you mentioned there, Harley Schlanger, is what Russia seems to be fighting. But isn't Russia leading the way towards a system that did not have positive results? Way back, not even that far back, from 2008 up to now, and we're seeing what the world is in terms of the economic doldrums that it's in, of course, taking away COVID, and I'm just saying what my knowledge is on this, and that's the printing of money that somewhat has led the world into the situation that it's in. Briefly, though, talk to us and tell us what this rules-based order is that Russia is fighting, that the West, led by the U.S., feels that it has to go to war and for lives need to be lost in order to preserve it.
Well, it's not just Russia that's fighting it. As Fred mentioned, the global South is refusing to support the efforts to destroy and isolate Russia because they know what colonialism is all about. They've been fighting it. This is the old non-aligned movement, which is reemerging. Now, on the economy, look, the United States on Friday will hit its debt ceiling, which means it's been bailing out bankrupt corporations to the extent that they can keep printing money. But if they keep doing it, the inflation goes off the charts again. So the West has a limitation as to what it can do right now with the post-industrial order. What it intends to do, and what I mean by the rules-based order, is the control by international banks, Washington, Wall Street, and the City of London and Brussels. These are banks and institutions that have been looting the global South for years. And they're the ones that insist that no nation has a right to sovereignty. They have to abide by the rules of the bankers. Now, the Russians are committed to sovereignty. The Chinese are committed to sovereignty. So are the Indians, the Egyptians, the Brazilians. And so there's a natural orientation away from that. Now, the war is designed by the West to convince the rest of the world that you shouldn't work with Russia because Russia can be beaten. But I think what we're seeing is the loss of support for the West because of its commitment to policies that so many countries have experienced in the past and are looking to escape. So we are in a, you know, the question of who is lost and who is won. And in a sense, the military side is clear. Eventually, Russia will succeed, but at what cost? The more important question is, will a new monetary system come into existence? And just one other point here. I don't think Europe is going to stick with London and Wall Street, because I'm seeing very clear signs from France, from Germany, from Switzerland, from Italy, of a move away. They need Russia and China for resources and for markets. And I think that's why the change is inevitably against the unipolar order. The problem is they have a lot of weaponry to try and keep it in place.
So when we talk about the West, Fred Weir, if you agree with our guests there from Germany, what's there left of the West, the U.S. and... Fred Weir, hold on to your thought. We're unfortunately getting cut off intermittently. So let me ask you that question then, Harley Schlanger. When we talk about the West, based on what you just said, who would be left? You have the U.S. and who else?
Well, it's the U.S. and the United Kingdom and Brussels. Now, if you look at Germany, Germany is having to tolerate something that's intolerable. The pipeline, the Nord Stream pipeline, was blown up. That was a Russian-German cooperation. The Germans are in Germany now, we're dependent on solar power and wind power. They're trying to scrounge gas and oil from around the world, and we're not getting enough of it. A cold wave is about to hit, and we're going to see some real problems hitting the economy in Germany and also in France. So I think that the attempt to keep this alliance together by placing demands for more weapons, a gearing up of its industrial production, the West can't produce the weapons that are needed by Ukraine, or at least that are demanded by Ukraine. And Ukraine is running out of Soviet-era weapons, and NATO is depleting its stocks. Even in the United States, without an industrial, a real investment in armaments, and of course, $112 billion, that's a pretty big investment. But they're not going to have enough capability to continue this war. So I really think that we're going to see a shift.
Yeah, let's expand on that, because we need to, Fred Weir, if we have you, on this supply side of the topic here. Based on just one example, and this would be the production lever for artillery rounds for the howitzer, it's said that a long-range heavy artillery weapons that are currently used on the battlefields of Ukraine is about 30,000 rounds per year during peacetime. But with the Ukrainian soldiers fighting Russian forces, they go through that amount in roughly 2 weeks. There's no way that they can actually keep up with the production for that particular item. Now, you can go down the list here. So how can they even sustain, first of all, fighting Russia? And B, if this is the case, doesn't this mean that they have to make a decision? Unless the decision, which apparently is to continue, so they could ramp up production to meet the, I guess, the demands of the battlefield for Ukraine.
It will take some time, even if they do decide to go on a war footing. I think it was a U.S. Navy secretary who said the other day, I guess he was speaking out of turn, that within 6 months, the United States Navy will have to make a decision whether we're going to arm Ukraine or arm the United States Navy. They are up against it in terms of production, and it would require massive investments to go onto a war footing, as, for instance, the United States did do in World War II very fast, and which Russia is now doing. You know, it's not well reported, but the Russian economy is now in full mobilization mode, and all defense and defense-related industries are running three shifts a day, 7 days a week. The Russian side is ramped up to a full war footing, or will be pretty soon. They're also mobilizing. The math is in Russia is pretty solid for an effective war effort. In terms of Ukraine, which now is entirely supplied, it's completely dependent on Western imports for all of its military needs. Like it doesn't have any of the Soviet era weapons left. You know, the 152 millimeter artillery that was Soviet standard is all gone, and they're now using 155 millimeter NATO standard, which means that all the shells, not just the artillery pieces, but everything that keeps them running, has to be imported every day. It is a massive strain on Western industry, which is not going on. I mean, it's simply they're digging into reserves, stockpiles, and so on, but they are not going putting their industry on a full war footing, which they would have to do if this war is going to go on, you know, for more than a few more months.
If I could make a point there.
Yes, please, go ahead.
The U.S. and the British are also short of skilled labor. Even if they wish to have a mobilization, this is one of the discussions going on in the Pentagon right now, that they have a labor shortage, and they have people who don't want to go to work in the defense sector. The other problem Ukraine has is they not only need all their weapons imported, they need funds to run the government. They're being totally subsidized by the European Union and the United States. So the real question then is, why not negotiate? Why is the U.S. so insistent that there be no negotiation? And that gets to the point I was making. The concern for the U.S. is to maintain the old rules-based order, the imperial system. And there's no way they can do that short of maybe a provocation to nuclear war. And that's the danger. That's why negotiations have to take place. That's why my organization is fighting like crazy to bring the NATO countries and the United States population to say to the government, no more war, we can't afford it.
Well, when you talk about the case of the UK that you mentioned, and also we should talk about Germany and other European countries for that matter, Fred Weir, let's take the UK as an example. I mean, how much clearer can the writing be on the wall when you have the year 2023 starting out with a bang, with strikes from different sectors that came through from last year? I mean, also this year, this week, we noticed the humongous crowds that showed up in Portugal. We're talking about also crowds in different European countries. I think that's pretty evident. And yet you're having Germany that had, what, 100 billion euros? That's a special fund for Ukraine, the U.S. Well, gosh, I lost count there, but, you know, we're looking at about $70 billion there. And then the U.K., $1.5 billion, the UK so far for Ukraine. Is that accurate? I think it is. $304 million dollars in new military aid was just announced by Rishi Sunak. How are you going to answer to the people?
Well, I wouldn't underestimate the resilience of these societies and these political systems. I live in Russia. I'm a journalist in Russia, and I have to deal every day with catastrophic assessments of how Russia is going down the tubes and is doomed. And I see around me a lot of resilience in the society, in the political system. And so I don't want to go with those alarmist assessments. But yes, there is intense strain, and it's of a systemic nature in Britain, but also in Germany, which built its industrial prowess in the past 30 years on cheap Russian energy. You see a lot of German industries now looking to relocate to places where energy is cheaper because they simply cannot afford it. These are our systemic alarm signals that are visible. I wouldn't overestimate them. I wouldn't look for collapse anytime soon, but it's definitely tectonic plates are shifting in the world today, and this war is a catalyst for them.
Was there a tectonic shift when you had the German defense minister resign, Harley Schlanger? What do you think that meant? What happened there?
Well, I think the German situation is moving in that direction. The latest polls show that only 42% of the population support the current government, and that's been dropping dramatically. Now, Lambrecht, the current defense minister, was dragging her heels on providing the Martyr tanks and some of the other equipment that Ukraine was asking for. But the Social Democrats, who have to replace her, are having a hard time finding someone who will step in and do it. I think we're seeing at least the beginning signs of a revival of the peace movement in Germany. But on the other hand, one of the points Fred is making is the Germans have very little sense of national sovereignty right now. It's completely controlled by Brussels. And Brussels, there was an announcement last week of, in a sense, a de facto merger between the European Union and NATO. At the same time, Japan was brought into an alliance with the United Kingdom as part of global NATO, and the Japanese Prime Minister is saying that Japan will help NATO in containing Russia and China. So they are trying to expand their operations, but what we've been discussing is there are limitations to that.
I'm curious what a merger on paper between the European Union and NATO would look like. But unfortunately, we're just out of time here. Do apologize. Thank you, though. Harley Schlanger, spokesman for the La Ruche Organization. Fred Weir, thank you so much. Journalist and political commentator there from Moscow. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitakhvay and the team, it's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atta, the host of this program. We have a very special guest speaker for today's program, Sheikh Karimi. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Okay, Sheikh Karimi, according to the famous, we can say, narrations and the stories, the Satan, which was first an angel, and then it was called the Satan then, he was cast out of the heaven. And then he entered the heaven again in order to deceive Adam and Eve, and especially Adam. So how Satan was cast out of the heaven, and then he got back to the heaven again in order to deceive Adam? How is it possible?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First of all, let me correct you. Satan was not an angel at all. Uh-huh. From the beginning, he was a jinn created from fire.
Yes.
And although many people may have the same understanding, because he was among the angels, but it was because of his high rank for worshipping God for so many years. But his nature was different from that of the angels. He was a jinn.
Okay.
Now, as you rightly mentioned, according to the verses of the Quran, when Iblis, the Satan, was asked by Allah and was commanded by God to prostrate before Adam, all the angels did, but Satan did not do so because of the claim that he said that he's better than Adam. And then he was expelled from what the Quran calls it Al-Jannah. Now, the dear listener who has asked this question, his understanding from this Jannah is the eternal heaven. But the point is that there are a couple of viewpoints regarding this Jannah. Is it the eternal heaven or another place? So although some people have understood this Jannah to be the eternal heaven, but it seems that this is not the case for various reasons. First of all, the eternal heaven is the reward for your good actions. So we cannot claim that Adam was in that heaven before doing any deed. The second reason is that this Jannah is called, according to the Noble Book of Quran, Jannatul Khuld, the eternal heaven, which means that whoever goes into heaven will not go out of it. But we know that, Satan was in this Jannah and then he was cast out. And also Adam and Eve, they were in the same place.
Yes.
And then they were cast out as well. So we cannot claim that it was the eternal heaven. The third argument to reject this claim is that the eternal heaven is not the place for the entrance and for presence of Satan and him being able to deceive the people. So all these points refer to the fact that that Jannah is not the eternal heaven.
Yes.
So either, according to the narrations, it was a garden in the heaven or a garden on this very planet that we are living.
Yes.
So in each case, we can answer to this question that it was not the eternal heaven. It was a garden, either in the heaven or on the earth. It doesn't make any difference. So it was able for Satan to enter this garden, either in heaven or in on the earth, and deceive the Satan. This is one point. And the second point is that even if it was in the eternal heaven, we should not think that Satan can deceive human beings by being, physically speaking, present in that place. Although we rejected that, but we should not think that Satan is deceiving the human being through being present in a specific place. No. We know that in our time, with all these technologies, we have the, what we call it, the, 3D image, three-dimension image, without, physically speaking, presence in a place. You can have a kind of, connection to other people. So Satan can deceive people without being, physically speaking, present in that place.
Yes.
So we should not think that it has been the case that Satan was in the same place as Adam and Eve.
Mm-hmm.
It is a possibility, of course,